For the week of February 9th, 2014, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 224, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
Well, Michael, I guess you're still buried in snow, if I'm not mistaken, or is that now where you're headed? Because you're traveling all over the world and all over the United States, and wherever you go, there seems to be snow.
There is snow. Every 3 or 4 days, seems to be a new snowfall, but I have a new cell phone, so that's exciting. So I get to play with that while I'm trapped in the snow. I have a new iPhone 5S. I got a new tablet. Still syncing it all up. Got to learn how everything Siri is talking to me now. It's very exciting.
Wow. Okay. Well, is it like Her, the movie? Are you like Joaquin Phoenix now?
I haven't fallen in love yet, no.
Okay. Not with the phone, at least.
No.
Well, have you fallen in love with watching the Olympics, maybe?
No, because I am traveling.
Ah.
So I don't have easy access to a place where there is cable television or, you know, network television. So I, you know, did not see Jay Leno's last episode. I saw the opening ceremony, but I have not seen a lot of the games. So it's a very weird time for me right now.
Well, you know, it's funny you should mention Jay Leno, because joining us today for our Inside Baseball segment is Scott Collins, a TV reporter and columnist for the Los Angeles Times. He's going to be here to talk about what the last Tonight Show with Jay Leno means, not only for late night television and the late night television landscape, but also for the city of Los Angeles as its new host, Jimmy Fallon. He's going to be moving the show to New York City. The Berlin Film Festival, Michael, you might know, is also on right now. And there's only really one person that seems to be making all the headlines, and it's an actor who says he's not famous anymore. Can you guess who that might be?
I don't know.
Okay, well, and Michael, you said you can't watch the Winter Olympics, and I see that's not really a big excuse these days, because even though they're taking place right now, just in case nobody had noticed, here in the United States, NBC is giving those of us who couldn't make it all the way to Sochi, Russia, a new way to watch the games. And that, guess what, Michael, you can watch them online. Well,
not really.
Sort of, yeah. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
Well, there's a lot of hit movies around the world, and we are talking about the worldwide box office, but it's dominated by one film's breakout job. We've been saying since Frozen came out in Thanksgiving that Hollywood had abandoned family films. There were like no decent family films for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks.
That's because they released them all during the summer.
No, they're supposed to release them at Christmas time and all year long. That's stupid to stockpile movies for one part of the year. And we saw that there was a very poor Walking with Dinosaurs feature film. There was The Nut Job early this year in 2014. There was no well-reviewed, decent family film that had come out since Frozen back in Thanksgiving. That's here in North America. Now that has changed. Not only is the movie getting really good reviews, it's doing an incredible box office. And that's why the number one movie around the world is The Lego Movie, if that's its actual real name. I'll get to that later. The
what?
Lego Movie grossed $87 million worldwide. It grossed $69 million in North America. It set some sorts of records, I'm sure, right? Family film in March or February or whatever this is.
Well, February is the coldest month for movies. I'm writing a story on For Celluloid Junkie on this. Is that I didn't know this. I always thought that January was the lowest.
No, because you've got the movies that opened on Christmas Day and limited, and then they expand in January, and they are big, high-profile movies.
That's
but
right.
They exhaust themselves by the time February comes along, and there's no new good stuff until, you know, Easter, really.
That's right. I never really thought about that. I guess I always thought new opening movies just fare more poorly in January than February. But alas, it is February that is the lowest grossing month.
No love for Hollywood movies in February.
So February, this is the record that it set is an animated movie opening in February.
Animated. So what's the record overall?
Passion of the Christ. Yes.
Was that number one and this is number two?
Yes, correct.
So forget animated. It's the second highest grossing movie debut of all time in North America in February.
Correct.
And what was the Passion of the Christ? What did it do?
The $1 million.
$1 million. Wow, it's a lot of money.
I think it was 87 million, but I can't be sure of that.
Okay. So that's $69 million in North America, $87 million worldwide. It's an immediate franchise. Somebody said it's the best reviewed movie of 2014 so far. Well, big deal. It's February. And usually crappy movies come out in January, but it's a very well reviewed movie.
Yes. I mean, at one point, I think there were like over 100 reviews in on Rotten Tomatoes, and it still had 100%.
But what is the movie called?
It's called The Lego Movie.
Not really. If you see it in 3D, in a lot of theaters, not everyone, but in a lot of theaters, they had a different title if it was in 3D. If you were seeing the 3D screening, it was called Lego, The Piece of Resistance 3D. I have no idea why.
I'm going to look into that
before.
I'm looking into that.
I was thanks to our listener, Aaron. He's a very faithful listener. He gave me a heads up on that. I went to one theater's listings that didn't do it, but most others I saw in New York City, they had this weird dichotomy. Like, you would think it would just be the Lego movie 3D. But no, it was the Lego movie for the 2D screenings. And for the 3D screens, it had a different name. Lego, The Piece of Resistance 3D. It sounds like a sequel, but it's not. And if you see the movie, you know what The Piece of Resistance is. Not just a play on Pièce de Résistance, but an actual piece used in the resistance to fight conformity. It was a good movie. I saw it. I enjoyed it. Very clever. I don't know if you saw it, Sperling.
I've seen most of it. I have seen most of it, yes.
Most of it. What?
You know, just in pieces, because I would see pieces of it.
That doesn't count.
In various forms.
You haven't seen it. You went to showings and they showed you 10 minutes of it.
Yeah, and I've seen about 60 to 70 minutes of it already. Yeah.
All right. Well, it's a good movie. So that's the number one movie around the world. The number two movie around the world.
Well, you know what the sequel's going to be, don't you?
No.
Duplo.
And number two around the world is Frozen, the Disney animated film we were just talking about, still doing big box office. Another $31 million. It's at $913 million worldwide, thanks to a big opening in China. This looks like it's really going to get close, if not past, $1 billion. And number three is the George Clooney film, The Monuments Men. It finally came out. It made $22.7 million. It opened in North America only. So it was number two behind the Lego movie here in this market. You know, it's not a huge opening. It got mixed reviews, but it's an older audience. You think they would not be rushing their opening weekend. So I actually think this is quite a good opening for it. You know, it costs $70 million to make, which is not bad for a period flick set during World War II. It's a big starry cast. It will appeal to an older audience. We'll have to see how it does overseas. But, you know, I think it should have international appeal. And if they're lucky, I think it's going to be a profitable one for Clooney and his studio, Sony Pictures.
Well, can I just point out, they start moving around all these films at the end of the year, right? And
sure.
they moved around the Jack Ryan. Is it mm-hmm. Jack Ryan or Chris Pine Ryan or whatever?
That's right.
And they said, well, we're just moving it because, you know, there's too many films at Christmas time and we don't want to have it get buried. It opens in January and immediately tanks, doesn't get good reviews. Monuments Men, they've moved as well, saying, look, we just don't want it to get buried. There's too many films at Christmas. It opens, it gets middling reviews. And now they're saying, oh, gee, we expected it to do a little bit better. I agree with you. $22 million for a film like this, not so bad, especially if you can keep it going for a little while. But, you know, they tried to downplay all of these moves at the end of the year.
But there's plenty of times where the moves are just strategic moves.
Right.
And a film's release date does not mean the movie is damaged goods.
I agree with you. However, if it walks like a duck and
say it looks like it's going to be crappy, so we're going to move it. What are they supposed to say?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm just saying, sets a precedent. It sets a precedent.
No, it doesn't. But the precedent's been broken. Plenty of movies have been moving that do great business and get good reviews.
Well, if I were you, you know what I would say? Name one.
Titanic?
So how about this number four movie, Wolf of Wall Street?
Okay, the number four movie around the world is The Wolf of Wall Street from Martin Scorsese and Leo DiCaprio. Another $21 million. It needs every penny. It's at $257 million worldwide. And number five, a big release in China and surrounding territories, The Monkey King. This is, of course, one of the many versions of Journey to the West, a classic epic Chinese tale. It made $21 million. It's at $116 million and counting. And number six, RoboCop. That's expanded into more territories. Hasn't come to North America yet, but it made $20 million and it's at $28 million worldwide. And number seven is The Man from Macau, the latest in the Gods of Gamblers series that stars the great Chow Yun-fat. Another $13 million. That's at $45 million. And then another Chinese film, Dad, Where Are We Going? That documentary film spinoff of the reality TV series. It made $12 million. It's at $81 million. It's going to be coming to Fox or some other North American network any day now.
You think so?
Oh,
is that true?
Of course. How could they not mimic this format? It was a big hit in South Korea. It's a monster hit in China. Somebody has already gotten the rights to this and will do it in North America.
So you don't mean the actual movie. You mean like the format.
I mean, the format, yeah.
It'll come to
American
absolutely.
Television. Yeah, absolutely. I don't know why they wouldn't. I mean, the celebrities probably mean nothing to most of us, so I doubt they would bring the film here, but you never know.
Well, wasn't Chow Yun-Fat in both The Monkey King and The Man from Macau?
Is he in The Monkey King? I think so. I haven't seen it. I think you're right now. He's one of the gods. In fact, perhaps one of the lead gods. So that's right. I remember seeing his name in the film credits when I glanced to see what the movie was and who was in it. So yeah, he's having a good week.
Yeah.
And number nine is American Hustle, another $10 million. That's at $192 million worldwide. And number 10, a big hit here in North America, is Ride Along, $9 million. It passes the $100 million mark. It's made $105 million. It's still the number three movie here in North America. It only cost $25 million to make, so it has quadrupled its budget, at least its official budget. Ice Cube, you know, he makes these movies. I'm sure he gets his money. He deserves every penny. He is a really good man to make films happen, a really great producer, a really good actor. He knows how to make profitable films. So he and Kevin Hart are looking good. There's already a sequel in the works. Will they release it overseas? I can't imagine why not. It's an investment in the future. At number 11, Jack Ryan, Shadow Recruit, another $9 million. It's at $114 million worldwide. It's made $70 million of that overseas, so it's almost doubled what it's made in North America. That trend should only grow in the weeks to come. At number 12, Miss Granny, another Chinese. Is that Chinese?
That's a Korean, South Korean film.
South Korean, that's right. Made $8 million, $38 million worldwide. 12 Years a Slave made another $7 million. That's well past the $100 million mark at $108 million. I say well past because for a film of that budget and that type of serious low-key drama, that's a very big sort of a take for that movie. And number 14 is Vi, the Russian film based on the Gogol short story. It's probably more horror than literary. It made another $6 million. It's at $28 million. And at number 15 is That Awkward Moment, also making $6 million. And that's at $20 million total. So that only cost $8 million to make. So while it didn't do great, it's certainly been smart counter-programming, if that's the word, for this movie that is sort of geared to chicks but stars dudes. It costs $8 million to make. It's made $20 million. So they're all going to be fine once all is said and done. I guess Zac Efron is still bankable.
Yeah.
And at number 16, this must have opened up overseas. I'm not sure what territory it's in. That didn't open up in North America yet. It's Mr. Peabody and Sherman, a spinoff from the Rocky and Bullwinkle show. This was a cartoon TV series that had multiple different segments in it that would recur week after week. Mr. Peabody and Sherman was the segment with a little smart dog and his boy. The dog was incredibly smart, built a time machine called the Wayback Machine. He didn't need a DeLorean. He built his own machine, and they would go through history and wreak havoc. The little boy would get in trouble, and the dog, Mr. Peabody, would rescue him. They've made a film about it. It's sort of cheeky and weirdly subversive. It's sort of the early reviews I get. They don't know if it's going to work here in North America, but somewhere in the world, it made $6 million.
Well, it is the Chinese Lunar New Year, or Chinese New Year, Lunar New Year. I mean, there's AKAs going on there. I guess maybe it opened in Asia somewhere.
That's possible. No telling.
Yeah.
And also making $6 million, as just to wrap it up, is Lone Survivor, the Mark Wahlberg film that also made $6 million. That's at $118 million worldwide. Oh, and just under $6 million is I, Frankenstein, the comic book spinoff turned into a feature film. Just under $6 million, and it's made $50 million so far worldwide. And we got a little news about movies coming up. It's sort of a weird one. Conspiracy theories are floating around here at Showbiz Sandbox. It has to do with the movie Noah, starring Russell Crowe. We talked about the ad that aired during the Super Bowl, which we both thought was terrible.
It was not a very good ad.
No. Not a good ad. And it's coming to the world soon, and it's going to be released in 3D all over the world if you don't speak English. What?
That's right.
In English-speaking territories, they're only releasing Noah in 2D. This is Paramount's decision. So you've got North America, meaning Canada and the United States and the UK and Australia, and that's about it, right? In
yes.
those territories, it's only being released in 2D. They're not bothering to release it in 3D, but they've spent $10 million after the movie was made. They suddenly said, you know what? This should be 3D. And they spent $10 bucks to post-convert it.
That's right, because it was shot in 2D. Keep in mind.
It was shot in 2D, and it was not conceived in 3D. They didn't shoot it with the idea that they would post-convert it.
This
was a 2D film, and suddenly at the end, they said, let's spend the $10 million so that in all those other countries, we can release it in 3D. So that's what they've done, and the question is, why? Has this ever happened before?
I would have to go back and check.
I don't think so.
I don't think it's happened where it was only
English language territories. They didn't bother, but everywhere else in the world, China, Japan, Central and South America, you name it, Africa, it's going to be in 3D as optional to be shown in 3D.
Yes, and there are a couple reasons for this, I think. And now these are all
make more money.
They want to make more money, but also in foreign territories, they're hoping it's an effects-laden film, especially the flood at the end. There's a flood?
Way to spoil.
Yeah, well, gee, you know, that story hasn't been told before. It's like the Monkey King, for Pete's sakes.
You're right.
It's probably been told 5 times by Hollywood already this year. As a way to attract audience members in countries where the native language is not English, they're hoping that maybe you know, the big action flood sequence in 3D would attract a few more viewers as well. I'm sure it's a little bit of a carrot to those territories where digital projection has not caught on or has not been rolled out as fully yet, because now that there's no more film prints, I think there was some film recently, and I can't remember the name of it. They only made 200 film prints, and I can't remember.
Worldwide?
In the U.S.
Oh, well, yeah. But I mean,
I want to say it was Jack Ryan. I could be wrong about that. But needless to say, maybe it was Lone Survivor. I can't remember. But
well, I thought there were movies that were all digital releases in the U.S.
Well, yes, Paramount is only releasing films digitally henceforth, except for, you know.
What's that got to do with the 3D of Noah?
They don't have film prints to send to these other territories. Often what would happen is a film would play its run here in the U.S. or Australia or the U.K. They would take those film prints and then they would send them to Thailand, or they'd send them to the Philippines, or they'd send them to Germany. And they'd
But now they're doing worldwide releases. They're releasing too quickly to do that, right?
That's right.
These days, you just can't do that.
That's right. Well, and there's no film prints to do that, so there's no used film prints.
It's a double problem.
So that's a double problem. I also think that I'm not sure about this, but I don't know if they're releasing day and date all over the world.
They are. There are many, many countries. The 27th, the 26th, the 28th of March. It's all over the world.
Okay.
In 3 days. You get more territories on April 3rd and April 9th and April 10th, but you've got like 30 territories opening up around the day or two. Egypt, Philippines, UAE, Argentina, Chile, Czech, Greece, Hong Kong, Hungary, Israel, South Korea, Lebanon, New Zealand, Peru, Portugal, Serbia, Russia.
All right. We're not...
On and on. Right.
Well, so, yeah. My initial
argument that they weren't ready with the 3D in time for North America is no good.
Yeah, no. Then I take it all back. Of course, this was an argument we had before we started recording.
But you're missing the forest for the trees.
That's right, because really, 3D is still kind of quite popular overseas.
No, you've got it backwards. 3D is dead in North America. People don't give a damn about it. They're not going to be tricked anymore. It's not worth even when you've spent the money to do it, it's not worth releasing it in North America because people could smell, and it will taint the film and make the movie look even crappier. So, you know, you don't want to release it in 3D in North America because people know that's just a total ripoff, that it's been done post. It's lazy and lame. It wasn't intended to be seen in 3D. They're sick of 3D in general. It would damage that brand even further, and they know they can't get away with it. It's another sign of the demise of 3D. It's not that it's popular elsewhere. It's that it's dying so quickly here in North America. And in fact, the rest of the world, they're going to drive it into the ground too. It's going to go in the same bell curve like you've seen here. Watch it collapse in the rest of the world. People are going to say, why did I spend extra to see Noah in 3D? It wasn't done very well. It wasn't meant to be seen that way. I feel ripped off.
Right. And like I said, it has the added benefit of, for those territories where it's digital conversion has not actually
It's no lure. If people go see the movie and they're angry, how is that a lure? This was bad 3D. I feel cheated. How is that a lure to the theaters to convert quickly so they can show more crappy movies from Hollywood that were lazily converted to 3D at the last minute just so they could charge an extra $4?
Well,
how is that a lure?
Well, because
in North America, they know if they showed this movie in 2D and 3D screens, that the 3D screens would be relatively empty and the 2D screens would be full. That's the lesson they've learned.
Well, because if you're a theater owner and you watch everybody walk across the street to your competitor who's showing it in 3D.
But they're not going to.
Well, that's not true.
They come out of the competitor screening and go, boy, that was bad. Boy, I feel ripped off. The special effects were not good.
That might be true 2 years from now, but right now that is not the case.
That's where they're headed. Well, anyway, it opens up in China. We don't know when. There is no release date yet set for China because, you know, they have a quota. And movies.
Well, what's the quota? We should explain for those who haven't been keeping score here. The quota is 34 films per year coming into China from outside. Now, those are imported movies, whether they're from France, Germany, or the U.S. It just so happens they're predominantly, if not entirely, from the United States.
They're almost. They had one from Australia last year, but it was Baz Luhrmann's The Great Gatsby. So
okay.
Chalk that up to another one being from Hollywood, essentially. But yes, China has a quota. Now, 3 years ago, it was 20 movies.
That's right.
Then they released it. They bumped it up to 34. And now there's a story in The Hollywood Reporter saying that they're looking, perhaps, they're always in negotiations. Hollywood is always pushing for more. And they're now talking about maybe bumping it up another 10 films to 44 movies. So that would have doubled the number of foreign films being released in China over the last 3 years. It would have doubled from 20 to 44. So hopefully that will happen. Of course, if they actually followed the law, I mean, they're members of the World Trade Organization. They don't have the rights to block any film into China.
Right. Well, they do have a right to censor the film. Meaning they could, you know, oh, you got to cut that 2 seconds out, or we have to cut that scene out because that's against our censorship rules here in the country. They do not have a right as part of the World Trade Organization to block it and say you can't release it.
So these are foreign films. And for China, that means, of course, films that were not made in China or Hong Kong, right?
That's right.
But some people say, hey, don't make it a quota for foreign films. Make it a quota for Hollywood films because we're here in France and Germany and, Spain and all these other countries. We can't get any of our movies into your country. And why do you care? We're not going to be a big box office threat. We just want to get shown and seen and get a chance to be there. Why don't label us a foreign film? Turn that foreign film designation to a big studio blockbuster designation.
Yes, and that is what France and Germany and a lot of the European countries are trying to do because they're getting blocked out by this quota. And the U.S. films, the big, high-budget IMAX movies, are kind of filling that quota, which is precisely what the quota was meant to do. And unfortunately, Les Untouchables or any of these films from France or the U.K. or Germany.
Oh, you, Goethe.
Yeah. Is it Goethe? Goethe.
Well, they mispronounce it, you know.
Oh, okay.
Suck me, Shakespeare, okay. As they say in English.
Okay, well.
That German hit, they want to be in China, but they can't get in there because China only has this quota of 34 films, and they're almost always all big Hollywood blockbusters.
Right. And
so the effect is that despite their having little threat at the box office, they're seeing no movies for most of the world.
Correct.
Not good. Of course, in Berlin right now, they are seeing movies from all over the world because in Berlin, they're having the Berlin Film Festival, which I've never been to. Have you?
No, I have not.
Shia LaBeouf is acting up in Berlin, but he is not melting down, as some people say. Oh, he's acting crazy. He's clearly doing performance art. He clearly is running with this gimmick of, you know, performance art. He got caught plagiarizing and has not shown the proper remorse or proper appreciation of what he did. But since then, he's been using this as an opportunity to have a goof.
Shia LaBeouf,
when he apologized, yes, he was accused, of, not accused, he's been fairly well admitted that he ripped off these other comic books in creating his own graphic novel series, which he has not wildly profited from, but he did do it.
And it's Daniel Clovez is the author.
One of the people that he ripped off, yes.
Right, and so we should point that out.
You say Clovez, it's C-L-O-W-E-S. Why are you saying it with a V?
Because I've interviewed him, and he pronounced his own name, Daniel Clovez. So
it's Clovez with a V? That's how you say it? Okay, thank you.
And so Shia LaBeouf, the actor, who is in Nymphomaniac, which is, I guess, premiering at the Berlin Film Festival.
Well, no, this is a new version of it premiering.
Oh, okay. It's his. Right, it's the director's cut.
At Sundance.
Yeah, well, only one half of it premiered at Sundance.
Then only one half of it's premiering in Berlin.
Okay.
It's in longer director's cut. They're showing it at Berlin. It often happens that movies get shown at multiple festivals. Anyway, he did get caught for this plagiarism. He insists it's just art. It's what we do. And since then, he's been having a goof. He did a skywriting thing. He apologized, but he plagiarized his apology quite knowingly. That was kind of funny, I have to admit. Now he's gone to Berlin. They had a press conference for this movie, Nymphomaniac. He storms out after 10 minutes. No, he didn't. He was acting. He quoted a world-famous football player, or soccer, as we
Eric
call it.
Eric Cantona. Yes. He was the subject of Looking for Eric, the Ken Loach film.
That's right, which we saw at Cannes and found quite enjoyable.
Yes.
It's well worth checking out. And LaBeouf quoted this very famous Eric Cantona quote that he gave in a press conference, and he stormed out of the press conference. That's what Cantona did, and that's exactly what LaBeouf did. A guy asked a question. He gave this quote, "When the seagulls follow the trawler, it's because they think sardines will be thrown into the sea. Thank you very much." And then he left. And everybody knew what the reference was. Everybody got it. So right. This is not him having a bizarre meltdown. This is him doing performance art. Then he went to the screening, the premiere, and he put a paper bag over his head and wrote on the paper bag, "I am not famous anymore."
Right.
Clearly, he's having a good time.
Well, and he showed up on the red carpet dressed in a tuxedo before the rest of his cast and crew.
So he wouldn't distract from them, yeah.
Right. Walked the red carpet. Nobody could get a real picture of him. And he did this stunt. He went inside. They took all the group pictures and everything with Lars von Trier, the director, and Uma Thurman and Christian Slater, all the actors and actresses from the film. They did their group picture. He's not anywhere in them now. And so, I thought it was a good stunt, if only to gain publicity for the film.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's an extra half hour in length here in Germany, which Hollywood Reporter Variety jokingly dubbed as bigger, longer, and uncut.
Oh,
as a play off the South Park movie. And they basically said they couldn't figure out what.
I thought that was a double entendre, not a play off the South Park movie, but go ahead.
Well, it's clearly a reference to the South Park movie, which is itself a double entendre.
Okay.
of course, it's a reference to that. Okay. What else could it be?
All right.
You don't think it's a coincidence that they said bigger, longer, and uncut, do you?
Well, I'm sure they're both referencing.
That was the joke in the South Park film.
Okay.
Sometimes I feel like we're in alternate universes.
Well, you are in New York.
I am
in LA.
And you're in LA.
Yeah. So, you know, we are in alternate universes.
And you're watching the Olympics and I'm not.
Well, actually, I'm not watching the Olympics. I didn't watch the opening ceremony. You know what? I can't stand it watching the Olympics on tape delay when they say, "We'll be right back after these messages." And I'm thinking, what? You just show me the darn thing.
You DVR it and you fast forward.
Yeah, but that's delaying it even
further.
Well,
you can wake up and watch it online if you want. You can watch it live. Go to your heart's content, NBC.com.
That's right. I can do that because I am a Time Warner Cable subscriber. And
that's
I have
right.
to be. I have to be a Time Warner Cable subscriber because that's, first of all, the only company that services the cable where I live. And thank you for the United States geographic monopolies on cable providers. But also, I have to be a cable subscriber to actually stream the Olympics online.
Yeah, you can watch half an hour of it, and then you can watch like 5 minutes a day after that if you're not a subscriber to a particular cable company.
That's right.
But NBC has the website. It had the apps. If you are a subscriber, then you can watch. And it's a good question. You know, they have to provide an over-the-air signal in order to be a broadcaster and to have the access that they do to the airwaves.
That's right.
Should they legally have to make streaming available? Is that the new over-the-air? Should they be allowed to block the general public who just wants to watch the Olympics or NBC in general from watching the network?
Well, let me explain this. Over-the-air is actual spectrum that the FCC has auctioned off and sold to NBC, ABC, CBS, and other network broadcasters.
I thought they were given the over-the-air spectrum in perpetuity as...
Yeah, I'd have to look that up, whether it was sold or
I think
provided
the original one, they have more spectrum that they do auction off.
Right.
And they have some digital rights that they say, well, do you want to add more channels or do you want to sell it, which we'll do. But I believe, I may not be right, but I believe that the networks have sort of grandfathered into the spectrum that they have as networks.
Right. And as part of those networks, they have to do these public service, you know, they have to...
To air political campaign debates, they have to have public service, they have to have news programs, children programming, etc. All sorts of little rules.
Right. And one of them is to broadcast over the air. They're now doing this digital, so it's a digital broadcast, but you can still stick an antenna up and grab that digital broadcast and for free, watch television.
And they say, we're fulfilling our obligation.
As part of that obligation, it is not, well, I should say, not as part of that obligation.
there you go.
That's really what I wanted to say.
Hello, Alice. We're in Wonderland.
Yeah. They don't have to stream online. That is not, mainly because
of course not. Yeah.
Because
it
wasn't
exist.
Around. Yeah, it didn't exist when these obligations were put into place. So part of their public service is not providing you with the opportunity to see the Olympics on your computer.
NBC says, hey, we're making most of our money over the air. That's where we make our money in prime time. And then the cable channels that we have and all that stuff, that's where we make our money. If we start streaming it online, that will be to audiences that are not paying for it. And therefore, we'll be losing that money. Most of our ads come from the over the air. But I say the money will follow where the eyeballs are. You're just giving up an opportunity. If people want to watch this stuff live and they happen to be cord cutters, well, guess what? You suddenly have people watching your streaming video, you know, coverage of the Olympics that wasn't going to watch it otherwise. They don't subscribe to your network. They don't have cable. They don't have a satellite. They're sitting at home. They are cord cutters. If they want to watch your website or your app and you get those eyeballs, you get to put ads in front of back. If that, if your audience explodes there, well, guess what? You'll make a lot more money. I mean, advertisers don't care where people
watch.
Yes,
but it's how much more money and what are the CPMs, the cost per impression of the
online
streaming.
Well, it'll
always be a
better buy to buy it over at the network when you got 32 million people watching the opening ceremony. That's clearly a very, very inexpensive, smart buy, right? Just as you saw with the Super Bowl.
Right, but think about it this way.
100 million people for pennies.
Think about it this way. The newspapers gutted themselves by providing all of their news for free online, and the advertising online was not sold at the same high rate as print publications. So they don't want to do the same thing, and I can understand that. They don't
want...
Well,
they can charge higher ad rates, but again, we're talking about the Olympics. It's very different from, you know, The Blacklist, shown Monday nights at 10. We're talking about once every 2 years, 2 weeks of more coverage and more stuff than you can ever show on television. They take hundreds of hours and condense it down to 3 hours in prime time. They have stuff daytime, 24 hours a day on the cable channels. There's more material than you can ever use. So to black it out and not let people who are desperate to watch, you know, speed skating live at 2 a.m. or something, to not let them do that because you're worried about it'll hurt your prime time, it's stupid. You've got 10 gazillion hours of programming. Shove it all out there in 800 different ways.
Now,
it'll all work out.
Now, you're arguing about actually being able to watch an event, whether it be live or later.
Right.
And there are some people out there, and I know this wasn't in our lineup here and in our show notes, but have you heard about this whole game called Last Man, where all of these guys try to be the last person to know the winner of this year's Super Bowl? Which actually,
oh no, that's very funny.
And they, so they don't watch the game. They try and avoid all the news. They don't have Twitter on. They, you know, they, and it's apparently some game where they're trying to be the last person to actually be aware of who won the game.
That's hilarious. I wonder if they know who won World War II. because you know, if they kept that guy and the Japanese soldier on the island is probably the last one to find out who won World War II. That man who just died. He was a soldier on an island. He never returned home. He didn't realize the war was over. He was there for like, I want to say at least a decade, but he was there for many years after the war was over, and he became a national figure, and he just passed away in Japan. But I mention that because the Military Times had a funny story. They talked about the opening ceremony and all the attention, and they talked about the sensitivity over World War II and how Russia's like, by the way, we lost 20 million people in World War II, and they really want the world to know it. And World War II was going to be included in the opening ceremonies because it's, of course, a searing, huge part of Russian history, something they're wildly proud of, their fight against Nazism and how they bled dry the Nazi army when in Stalingrad and elsewhere. And the IOC said, no. World War II is still too sensitive an issue.
Too soon
for World War II. So that's why that was not in the opening ceremonies. I'm sorry you didn't watch it. As all opening ceremonies from now until the end of time, I would say it was not as good as Beijing. But they had some very interesting technical stuff with projections onto the floor. I mean, it was not a great, it was an okay ceremony. My relatives found it very boring. I thought it was okay. But they had these projections on both sides of the main arena, and they projected video onto the floor, and it was like live animation. It was so vivid and real and looked physical. It was like the next step, I think, in sort of theatrical exhibition, I meaning live theater, not movies. But it was just an amazing effect. It looked really, really great. And once it becomes cheaper, I think it, along with digital screens, will really revolutionize theater and what people can do in concerts and theatrical events that people go to see live. It was really, some of it was quite stunning.
Well, that's called pixel mapping. Or 3D mapping or 3D pixel mapping. And if you go to celluloidjunkie.com, I write up a piece from Sundance about how Sundance did that this year for their festival bumper. Their festival trailer was a 3D pixel map onto the actual theater, the cinema, in which the festival kind of makes its home.
Okay, well, you should check it out. I thought it was a pretty big deal as far as a next step forward in technology.
Oh, big deal. So it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story In a replay of what happened in the U.S., the Canadian government has forced top publishers to end the practice of agency pricing. You might recall this, right? This is a clear victory for Amazon and will force retailers to lower their prices. That's a win for consumers in the short term, but arguably a loss in the long term if it means more and more retailers will go out of business or essentially abandon books in favor of other items like, I don't know, biscotti or coffee. In the U.S., the second largest bookstore chain has gone bankrupt, Borders. You might recall us talking about that. And the largest is teetering on the edge of bankruptcy itself, Barnes & Noble. Both have had more than 600 stores around the country. Barnes & Noble plans to close at least a third of them. The next biggest chain, Books A Million, has only 200 locations, none of which are close to me. Much of them smaller than the superstores of the two leaders. Big deal or big what, Michael?
Big deal. It means you're going to get lower ebook prices, and 5 or 10 years from now, you may regret it.
Yeah, well, that's true, because what happens when 5 or 10 years from now, there's no place to buy them except for Amazon and iTunes?
I wish some government would look at the fact that, like, you're forced to buy a book that only works on, like, their e-reader. You can only read a book that works on Kindle or the Kindle app. Yeah, it's as if you bought a CD and it only played on an Amazon stereo. I think that's outrageous, but they don't seem to investigate that.
They will at some point, don't you think?
Like, I hope so.
Legislation always seems to lag behind technology. In this case, it's almost embarrassingly lagging behind, but we'll see. Are you ready for some football? Is that how I'm supposed to say that, Michael?
That's sort of that. Sort of right. Okay. A little Charlie Daniels. Very good.
Okay. CBS is bringing a package of the NFL to Thursday night. It will start in late summer and end in early November, so the powerhouse CBS lineup, including the number one sitcom, The Big Bang Theory, will have its season debut delayed until November sweeps. Hey, guess what? That's less repeats. This gives ABC a Saturday night package, NBC a Sunday night package, ESPN a Monday night package, CBS a Thursday night package, and Fox and ESPN, and the rest all over the schedule on weekends. Can you believe that? I mean, like, where am I going to watch football? I'm going to have to, like, actually have a chart and a spreadsheet to figure out where I'm supposed to go. And that means, of course, ESPN can enjoy all these bidders keeping the price of their programming sky high. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop. I want to know what's wrong with Tuesday and Wednesday.
Yeah, that's what I want to know.
Fill that sucker in.
And, you know, let's talk about something else for a second. The reason that football games were Sunday to Sunday, partly, not entirely, is because it was very difficult for players' bodies to recoup.
Now, yeah, I know, exactly. You play one game, then you have a game 4 days later instead of 7 days later. It's a big difference.
So it's like, let me bruise and damage your body, and then instead of giving you 7 days to recuperate, I'd like to do it to you all over again 2 days from now.
Well, they clearly, I think, worked their schedule to try and accommodate that as much as possible. They say, all right, you played Thursday this week. All right, now you won't have to play till next Sunday rather than, say, Monday. You know, they're clearly will try and avoid that as much as possible.
Yeah, well, you know, I think if it becomes a problem, much like this ebook issue, we think it's definitely going to be a problem. I think you should turn to your government. And when you do, I think that you probably or most likely will be turning to a former American Idol. I guess he wasn't an American Idol. He came in second, right?
He was an American Idol finalist.
Okay, well, and we're talking about Clay Aiken, who was the runner-up on season 2 of American Idol, but he still sold more albums than the eventual winner, which Ruben Studdard. Yeah. Maybe he has the same plan in politics. Aiken, who came out as gay but has a serious heartland following, is running for Congress in a district that is historically very conservative. Whether he wins or loses, Aiken might be raising his profile again and convincing people to see him in a new light. Aiken hasn't laid out much of a political agenda, but at least it's clear who would be singing at his inaugural reception. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop. Okay. I don't know if he said something and was sort of interesting politically, then I'd wake up. But so far, it seems very bland and boring, but it's kind of funny, that's for sure.
Vanity Fair has an annual cover shoot celebrating the hottest actors in Hollywood, and it's usually a Lily White affair. And by Lily White, we mean, well, you know what we mean. They insist they're just reflecting reality. This year, just in time for the Oscars, Vanity Fair has a 3-panel foldout on its cover, and of the 12 stars included, fully half of them are black. Idris Elba, Chiwetel Ejiofor, Chad Boseman, and Lupita Nyong'o are among the stars, with Julia Roberts perched on Elba's lap. And ironically and surprisingly, there's George Clooney. I don't know what he's doing there. Now, where are the Hispanics? That's what I want to know. The Latinos, the Asians. And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal. It's a sign of these are, you know, rising stars. It's not just something that they did to make some political statement, but they are rising talent. But I want to know, where the heck is Barkhad Abdi?
Yes.
Got nominated for an Oscar, and he still can't get under the cover of Vanity Fair. Why do they hate Somalians?
You know, I was watching the Dallas Buyers Club again last night, and...
You watched it twice?
Well, yeah, because, yeah, people hadn't seen it.
Oh, my God. I did not like that movie.
I was actually in the process of putting together show notes for this podcast I do at the same time, because I'd already seen the movie. But
and it's not that good?
No, the podcast is great.
And the movie's not that good.
Oh, well, I thought it was
okay. No. Ugh.
Well, I you know, Jared Leto is like a skeleton in that movie at a point, and I thought, wait a second, who was thinner, Barkhad Abdi, who was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor, or Jared Leto, nominated for an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor? And of course, Barkhad Abdi was in Captain Phillips.
That's a good question.
Now, don't you think that most people believe that Barkhad Abdi is kind of a one-off? He'll
Well, of course, yeah.
He'll do this and he'll never act again.
Sure.
Okay. Well, actor Ryan Phillippe, he's been acting for a while, and now he is set to star in a new ABC drama based on an upcoming Australian drama. That's right. The Australian drama hasn't even aired yet. This 10-episode series called Secrets and Lies is about a dad who suddenly finds himself the main suspect in the death of his neighbor's 4-year-old son. That's bad news. Big deal or big what, Michael?
Well, I think it's a big deal because it's so misguided. What is the description of that show? How is that a TV series? That is not a TV series. And you're seeing this again and again and again on TV show after TV show, like Hostages last season. And I've heard a string of other upcoming shows where you're like, you hear the concept, the premise, you're like, that's not a long-running 5-season series. That's a mini-series. That's a TV movie. That's a telenovela. That is not a series. I don't get it. How can they not realize that even if it works for one season, there's nowhere to go in season two? It's ridiculous. I it's a really big problem. They're so obsessed with serialized drama and telling a long-running story, you know, like Lost or something, which, again, look at the problems there, by the way. That show fell off a cliff after season one. That they're not recognizing what works for a long-running show versus a miniseries versus a telenovela. They got to know the story and make the format fit it. Instead, they're bringing these crazily high-concept things that would only last for 8 or 10 episodes and trying to turn it out into 20 episodes in 2 or 3 or 4 years. It doesn't work.
Well, and I would like to qualify. You say that Lost fell off a cliff after the first year, and by
it
that
went down a hole.
And by that you mean narratively, not ratings wise, where it kind of
it also faded.
It faded out
well
slowly.
Down. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, you know,
it lost a lot of momentum ratings wise.
Well, America has its Comic-Con, but France has the annual Festival International à la Bande Dessinée, whatever, Dessinée, I don't know. I apologize to the French-speaking world for what I just did. And it's a lot more controversial, this festival, I'm not going to do it twice. The winner of the Lifetime Achievement Award, called the Grand Prix, they're supposed to go to someone who traditionally chairs the following year's event and puts their personal stamp on it. Europeans tend to dominate, but Americans have been nudging in with no small complaints from European artists. This year, Bill Watterson, the creator of Calvin and Hobbes, won the top prize, even though he didn't go, rarely gives interviews, and is unlikely to show up next year. British legend Alan Moore, another nominee, had turned it down in advance, just in case. That wasn't the end of it, though. Just like Scarlett Johansson, the festival was embroiled in SodaStream, a top sponsor that has a factory in the occupied territories of the West Bank. Many artists complained about the link to the company and demanded they be rejected in the future. On top of that, Japan was furious about major attention paid to a series of South Korean comics telling the story of Comfort Women, the South Korean women forcibly raped and turned into prostitutes by the Japanese army during World War II.
It's too soon, says Japan.
Yeah, well, you know, I have to say, like, if I am running the Festival International à la Bande Dessinée, I think I might be, I might just go, you know what, you guys do, you take it over.
I'm going to want a really good PR person.
That's right. It all makes arguing over who would win in a fight, Superman or the Hulk. Well, it seems kind of tame in comparison. And is Watterson's win a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, I think it's a very big win. I love the fact that it's acknowledging a comic
very
strip,
big win a, or a big deal.
It's a big deal. I love the fact that they're celebrating Watterson after all these years when the comic strip's been off of newspapers. He retired it at its peak. There's always been a little more respect for comic strips as opposed to comic books in Europe than there has been in the U.S. So that's cool to see. And this sounds like the Comic-Con I want to go to.
Yeah,
man. Sounds exciting.
Get all these guys in a room.
But it's always been a great festival and always a great way to highlight European artists we aren't familiar with. And you're seeing this trend of awards like the Folio Book Awards, which were, they just announced the nominees. And that includes like 5 Americans out of 8 nominees. We know the Booker Book Prize is opening up to worldwide, not just to the people in the Commonwealth. Now you see this happening here. The world is just, I think, too small now to try to ignore things regionally. Sometimes can get hard. You know, the other things want to push their way in, though you can see how, you know, the impact of the award gets lost a little bit as well. So it's a really hard balancing act. I think Booker maybe shouldn't be doing what they're doing. But this, on the other hand, feels like a nice tip of the hat after they've got such a rich tradition of comics in Europe that I think it's okay to acknowledge some of the other artists around the world like Bill Watterson.
Well, it's no surprise to people who listen to Showbiz Sandbox, but the X Factor has been canceled. The American, version. The ratings were never great and fell throughout the 3 seasons that it was on. The popular judge, Demi Lovato, who I wish she would stop going to the Calabasas Commons because every time she's there, she brings the paparazzi. That's all I can say. She was the popular judge, and she said she was going to be focusing on her next album instead of The X Factor, and she wasn't going to return to the show after 2 seasons. Then Simon Cowell said he would not be judging either. Granted, this was the show he left American Idol for, but that's another story. The UK X Factor has been a huge hit, but it's been soft in the ratings, and he wants to return to that, to the British version of The X Factor, and he wants to shore that up. What? No Simon Cowell? Fox saw the handwriting on the wall, and the writing did not say, let's get 3 new untested judges and launch a 4th season. So the X Factor has been canceled here, even though it's been a huge, big hit worldwide as Idol and even the U.S. managed to launch some promising careers, including season 3 winners Alex and Sierra. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. We could see, we knew it was going to end. We kept predicting it would end. There seemed no reason for a 4th season whatsoever, but it is weird. I feel like they've found the best talent in the last 2 or 3 years of all these talent shows. I think they've had the best track record, and I think you're going to see 1 or 2 of these people. I mean, they've already done quite successfully overseas, but I think you're going to see one or two of these people break out. Maybe Alex and Sierra, they've had like 2 number one hits on iTunes already.
And then they'll bring the show back saying, you know,
But you're going to see that the show's legacy was, hey, they actually discovered some stars, and that's something that The Voice has never come close to saying.
Okay, well, I think the stars that they launched were Adam Levine of Maroon 5. And
already a big star, Christina Aguilera, CeeLo, and Adam Levine. Thank you very much.
I know, I'm just
He's the sexiest man alive, and you're still bitter about it.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. But, you know, the funny thing about The X Factor and The Voice, those people are actually singing. They're not just lip-syncing. But the band members of the Red Hot Chili Peppers, they mimed along with a pre-recorded track during their halftime performance at the Super Bowl last week.
What?
Yep, the vocals were live, but the Super Bowl insists on pre-recorded music because the outdoor stage must be set up in minutes, in moments. They've got no time to do it. So many things can go wrong, and a pre-recorded track is just the way they do it. Audience members noted the band's instruments weren't even plugged in. That might have been a bit of a mistake, by the way.
No. Keep reading.
Well, they weren't plugged in, but exactly, said Flea. Why pretend they were playing when they could be honest and make clear they were only pretending to play? They wanted to give it away, give it away, give it away now. See what
very,
I did there?
Very good. Very
yeah. Good. Do you think I could, you know, if Anthony Kiedis, you know, decides to retire, what do you think? My chances
looks
are.
Looks like he has retired, but I was like, who is that old man?
I don't know if I look that good with my shirt off. Well, presumably the pre-recorded music edict applied to Bruno Mars as well, though his vocals were live all the way. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. It's just part of life for the Super Bowl and the way they do it. I wonder if Bruno Mars's drumming was pre-recorded though. Was that live? I have to think that would be live because to mime drumming seems kind of a lot harder than singing. You know, you can mumble a word or whatever, but the drumming looked spot on. So I don't know. Maybe those drumming was live. Then they went to a pre-recorded track with the full band and pre-recorded with the, you know, Red Hot Chili Peppers. You know, it's, you know, you've had other acts who even lip sync, like Madonna, I think lip sync some of hers because she's running around dancing. Just what are you going to do? If you want to have them running around dancing, entertaining you, they can't sing necessarily. You got to make your choice.
Well, the drums were mic'd at the Super Bowl. So
they were mic'd. That doesn't mean they were plugged in or meant to put a feed out to the world.
Okay, yeah,
I mean,
true.
The Red Hot Chili Peppers, and I kind of admire it, they're just like, look, we're not going to pretend we were doing it. Anybody paying attention will know that that was a pre-recorded track. And so I give them credit for that.
Yeah, and this is actually a long-running practice, the recording of something during, and guess who was it? Not Whitney Houston. Who am I thinking of? Beyonce during the inauguration of the second inauguration of Obama, I guess she lip synced to the Star Spangled Banner, or she lip synced something. When you are doing a live performance where so many things can go wrong and that many people are watching, you always have a
backup track in case your voice goes or the right. weather or something, but you don't always use it. But yeah.
Yeah. And you know, for years, I used to photograph the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade in New York City. And I would be right there in Herald Square, right where all the performers would do their thing for the national broadcast. And all of those things were, you know, click track. They all had tracks.
Well, and Whitney Houston didn't even have her vocals live at the Super Bowl when she famously sang the Star Spangled Banner, and that shot up the charts right during the Gulf War. That was lip synced. You know, she actually sang, but it was into a dead mic. She's like, well, this wasn't Milli Vanilli. She really sang. Well, not really. We didn't hear her singing, so I don't think that quite counts.
Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week. And then, as promised, it's time for Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, we're going to be joined by one of my favorite television writers and television reporters, Scott Collins from the Los Angeles Times, who wrote a very interesting piece, a couple of interesting pieces, one of which was an interview with Jay Leno. But he wrote an interesting piece about how Jay Leno's leaving The Tonight Show, or being pushed out of The Tonight Show, kind of is not only a big deal for The Tonight Show and for viewers of late night television, but also a big deal for Southern California and production in Southern California. Scott, thank you for taking the time to join us.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, you summed it up nicely in your piece. To quote, you said, where once Tonight was part of a vibrant complex that was home to Hollywood Squares, Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In, and other shows, the studios will, after this week, become another symbol of the runaway production that has seen more than $3 billion in film and TV crew wages slip away from Southern California over the last decade. The Tonight Show move will cost more than 150 local jobs alone. Leno understands that the loss of Tonight is a shock to the local system. Quote, that's kind of sad to see happen, he told the LA Times. And that really is one of the big stories behind this, isn't it? Almost all the big talk shows are back in New York, and that's just symbolic of how production has been slipping away from Los Angeles.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in Southern California, we still have a few, you know, broadcast shows that I guess you could call talk shows. I mean, like Ellen DeGeneres' show and the Warner's Lot is one. But, yeah, I mean, the Tonight move is certainly symbolic, and that's what I was trying to get at there. You know, really in the past 10 years, 15 years, there really has been an exodus of local production, you know, runaway production to Vancouver and New York and North Carolina and, you know, New Zealand and Czech Republic, you know, all these different places. And, you know, the Tonight move, because when Johnny Carson brought the Tonight Show out to Burbank in the early 70s, you know, that was a real cultural landmark for Southern California. It was almost as if there was a certain validation that had come from Johnny and from NBC that the moment for Southern California had arrived. And it coincided with a huge influx of people, really from all parts of the country, not just New York, but all kinds of people were coming to Southern California then. You know, the freeway system was exploding, population was exploding, you know, city services were exploding. And, you know, the Tonight Show move kind of encapsulated all of that in 1972. And then you have, you know, 42 years later, the show going back to New York, which I think strikes a lot of people here in Southern California as regressive. It's like, that's not the direction we want to go in.
Well, and it was kind of, I don't want to say shocking, but kind of disheartening, I guess, as somebody who lives in Southern California. But of course, New York is a media capital, so you can't really fault them for moving it to yet another media capital of the world. However, if you are Jimmy Fallon, granted you've lived in New York most of your life and worked on shows like SNL and Late Night, but isn't it going to be harder to book a guest when you have all of these shows in New York?
I would say, you know, maybe marginally. I mean, you know, a lot of the publicity campaigns go through, you know, and I'm talking about for movies and for TV shows, they move through New York at one point or another. And yes, I mean, I suppose there could be a heightened competition between, let's say, The Late Show on CBS and Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon, since, you know, they are going to be crosstown rivals now, not just, you know, cross-country rivals anymore.
But weren't they competing anyway? I mean, each one of them wanted the star, whether the star came to them in L.A. or New York. They were fighting for the same people first.
And I mean, that's not really new, and that doesn't really, I don't think it changes that much depending on where the Tonight Show is. A larger issue, I think, is that there are now, and I totaled them all up when I was writing about this, I think there are, on between broadcast and cable, there are now 21 late night talk shows.
Wow.
So that, you know, if you include Tonight Show and Craig Ferguson and Colbert and Jon Stewart and Chelsea Lately and all these different shows, there are 21. So the issue is, you know, will there be a booking war between, you know, this show, that show? Yeah, but I mean, the larger point is there are so many shows now that, you know, when you have 21 shows that are scrumming for the, you know, necessarily a limited pool of talent, that creates an issue. And also, I think there's an additional issue of talk show fatigue, of talk show sameness, so that you have kind of micro audiences now who declare their allegiance to Conan O'Brien or Colbert or whomever, and nobody really. I mean, one of the things I was thinking as I was watching Jay's last show is that, you know, this is kind of it for any one talk show accumulating a huge audience. I mean, now we've kind of reached the end. I mean, people say, well, how do you think Jimmy Fallon will do? I think Jimmy will do fine, but I really don't believe he's going to assemble anything like the ratings that Jay had at his peak. It's just not going to happen.
Well, and I guess there would be publicists who say, you know, it doesn't matter that there's so many, whether it's The Daily Show, The Late Show, The Tonight Show in New York, they just, I don't know, send their talent to New York for a week and they do all the shows one after the other. And that would be that. Of course, there would be some bookings where you couldn't do them all in a week because the shows don't want them on the same week that they appeared on The Tonight Show, or vice versa. But I agree with you. That struck me as well when I was watching the last Tonight Show with Jay Leno. Was, gee, he's, you know, he's number one right now in terms of, you know, late night shows. He gets the most viewers, but it is a number of viewers that has declined, at least for The Tonight Show, over the years. And I think that's partly because of this fragmentation, as you mentioned. But I also felt, gee, there will never be a show that becomes a part of, or a late night talk show like this that becomes a part of the, I don't know, common culture, if you will, the way that Johnny Carson's Tonight Show did, the way that Jay Leno's Tonight Show did. And it also struck me that I think part of what is turning people off to late night in general is this war. It is the fact that nobody likes to see a guy who's doing well get fired. And in this case, especially an older guy, and that's effectively what happened here.
Yeah, I mean, I guess NBC would say, I mean Jay certainly would say he got fired. I mean, I think NBC would characterize it more delicately, that they just, you know, they retired Jay and they brought in somebody younger, you know, so it was like giving him the gold watch. But in any case, you know, whatever happened, what's happening in the media world today is that people are, I mean, I think this has really already happened. They've kind of moved away from total brand loyalty. So they certainly don't have brand loyalty to any quote unquote network. And I'm not even sure that there's really necessarily show loyalty now. I mean, if you look at how people are consuming media, there's a lot of sharing that goes on. So, you know, there will be, you know, a little bit of people might on their Facebook feed, they might have, oh, here's something that was on Conan last night. Or here's something that was on Colbert last night. And there will be like a little video link that they will have, and they'll, you know, people will try to write a funny comment and you know, show to their friends that, oh, you know, I thought this was funny, and this tells you something about me that I thought this was funny. My suspicion is people in many cases, haven't even seen the entire show. They just watched the clip, if that. I think sometimes people are sharing things they haven't even watched. They just maybe watched a few seconds of it.
I think that's actually true.
But the point of it is that, you know, the whole idea of the common culture that you're talking about, I mean, I think that's, it's really long dead, because people don't need to sit and watch, you know, Johnny Carson. It used to be Johnny was on for 90 minutes, and people don't need to sit and do that anymore, and they won't sit and do it anymore, more to the point. They now, it's just, oh, you know, I saw it. What they mean is they saw a 20-second clip.
Right.
and they did not watch the show. And that becomes apparent when you talk to people. They really are not, they're not clear on the details, because they didn't put the time in to nail the details down. What they were really after is just the clip that they could share. And so it's become a sharing culture. It's not really a watching culture. But when you think about it, it makes perfect sense, because when you think about all of the multiple options that people have now, there's no way you could keep track of everything. Even if it's your job, you can't keep track of everything. Absolutely. I mean, I have people who come up to me all the time and they ask you, hey, did you see this show? And I'm like, what is that? And then I like look it up and I'm like, oh, okay, now I know what it is. But there has just been in the past decade an explosion of programming, of original programming. Everybody's in the original programming business because, you know, the business people have become convinced, and I think with good reason, that that's how you grow. You provide original content and you grow. The problem is that when everyone does that, the amount of growth that you're talking about, the returns are going to naturally diminish, because you're cutting the ultimate size of the audience down. Everyone's growing, but everyone's growing, I think, more and more and more modestly.
Well, you'd think that Hollywood would have known that, since they make, you know, two Snow White movies at a time, and both of them don't necessarily do well. But so now they're all in original content, and, you know, they're kind of eating each other's lunch. And I guess, so effectively, you're saying, hey, gee, Sesame Street lowered our attention span to 5 minutes, and that it was faulted for lowering the attention span of an entire generation, and now YouTube is lowering it even further to 30 seconds.
Some of that is natural. I mean, if you look at just how things are edited now, they're edited, and this has increased more and more. I mean, like, go back and look at feature films that were released in the 1980s, and which, you know, was a while back, but it's not that long ago. And it's within the memories of a lot of, you know, older adults who are alive now. And when you go back and you look at those movies, I mean, even a movie like Ferris Bueller's Day Off, I mean, seems edited at a glacial pace, you know, compared to what today's audiences want. You will just, like, look at it and you'll be like, wow, this is, like, really slow. And it's just that everything has gotten very high metabolism. And I think the video has, and I think, you know, the amount of video that people share. I mean, look, on Instagram now, people are sharing video, but it's like, well, it's 15 seconds, right? It's the limit on Instagram.
Yeah.
It can only be 15 seconds long. So, I mean, you've got to, I guess the virtue is that you've really got to compress something, you know, but the downside of it is that people just kind of flip through their feeds and they just get like 15 seconds of a video. And I think it explains why, the medium kind of dictates what's going to happen.
So, well, you don't have to go back to Hollywood movies. You can just watch old Johnny Carson clips, because they have them on Turner Classic Movies, where he'll have an interview with a big star and then they'll show one of the movies. And it's usually like a 9 or a 12 or a 15 minute clip of their interview from the Tonight Show, but it's thoughtful, it's intelligent, it's quietly. It just seems like some erudite PBS thing compared to what you get today. I mean, it's just the contrast between that and what happens now on late night is unbelievable. But you think about Carson.
Johnny used to have authors on. I mean, Johnny used to have Calvin Trillin would come on. I mean, can you imagine any talk show doing that today? I mean, seriously, like I mean, there may be the stray author here or there, but it's not. Tonight Show back in Johnny's day had authors on all the time, and no talk show today, none, not David Letterman. I guess you could say Colbert does. Colbert has, if you consider that a talk show, he's kind of playing a character, so it's not a traditional talk show. But
Daily Show as well.
You know,
The Daily Show has
Jon Stewart and Craig Ferguson, I think, does a lot. Exceptions. Craig Ferguson does. Craig Ferguson's also, I would say, more than authors, he has on eye candy young actresses.
And oh yeah,
that's what that show really, really operates on. But I think yes, the whole nature of the talk format has changed. But again, I mean, I think that follows other trends that the news business has gone through, transformations that the news business has gone through, and kind of what the expectations of the audience are. The audience now expects entertainment. They expect people to plug movies. They not really are expecting people to come out and deliver, you know, 10 minutes of thoughtful commentary about a certain news event or a cultural item.
Yeah, well, if you look at Carson and Letterman and you think about what is their legacy, for me, it was always the comics that they launched, the singers that they helped make their career, and they obviously have a list of people as long as their arm. Letterman, of course, everyone from Ray Romano to Bonnie Hunt to Jay Leno, naturally. But Leno, what is his legacy? Because when I think about him, there are some people that he was loyal to and had on a lot, like Wanda Sykes and Bill Maher, but he didn't make them the way the Letterman made other people, and of course, Johnny Carson made so many people. Does Leno, what is his legacy? I'm sure you've been thinking about it while you've been doing these wrap-up interviews with him and talking about the show.
Yeah, I mean, I think that for Jay, you know, Jay's a nightclub comic. I mean, that's primarily what he comes from. So I think what a lot of people are going to remember about Jay is the monologue. I mean, Jay is more of a nightclub comic than anybody else who has had one of these jobs. I mean, that is quintessentially where he comes from. He's not like Conan, who's a writer. He's not like David Letterman, who did do stand-up, but is really a broadcaster. I mean, he was a local weatherman for a while. I mean, the whole thing with David is, you know, kind of communicating with that camera. I think people will remember Jay's monologues, and I think also people will remember the way that the Tonight Show under Jay became a platform for politicos, because you have people like, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger, who came on to kind of suddenly off the cuff announce that he was going to toss his hat in the ring for the California gubernatorial race. So, you know, I think Tonight Show also at its height under Jay became kind of a way station for politicians. You know, Jay even said that at his last show that, you know, I got to meet presidents. And he did, because I think in much the same way that Larry King in an earlier generation became a way station for political people to come and talk and kind of explain their point of view, I think that Jay and the Tonight Show became that for a while. Really, I think kind of in the 2000s, you know, like 2000 to 2010, you know, really the height of Jay and the Tonight Show, it became an important stop for people to come and talk and it, to have a more relaxed setting than you would get on, say, Meet the Press or one of those other Sunday talk shows.
Well, and President Obama was on the last Jay Leno show saying, kind of giving him some advice on what Jay Leno should do next. He said that he's going to make him ambassador of Antarctica for, you know, all those funny jokes.
Yes.
And, you know, it got some serious ratings. 14.6 million people watched. And, you know, I guess he did this heartfelt goodbye. It really did feel final, whereas the last time Jay Leno left The Tonight Show, it was, well, he was just going to move to 10 p.m., so it wasn't that big a deal. This felt like a much bigger deal, and he really did. There was some finality to it. And so what did you think of the last show? What do you think Jay Leno is going to do now? In your interview with him, he says, I'm not going to do another late night show.
Right, right. One thing I wanted to add about Jay and kind of his legacy, I see Jay as a transitional figure, but by transitional figure, I mean he's somebody who kind of is a link in late night talk shows, at least, between the huge audiences of the past and the mass TV culture that we saw in Johnny Carson's day, and, you know, he's a bridge to where we're going, which is, you know, a sharing culture. It's a place where people are just you know, they're really more about sharing clips on social media than they are actually sitting down and watching something while it's being broadcast live, because that increasingly is not happening at all unless you have the Super Bowl or the Olympics or something like that. So, you know, for Jay, what he's going to do, I think Jay is certainly going to go, continue on the road like he has been, because he is he's a total nightclub comic. I mean, that's what you're really talking about is somebody who, when you strip away the Tonight Show, gilding and all of that, he's really a lot like Henny Youngman. I mean, he's a guy who comes out and delivers one-liner after, just joke, 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 joke. That's what he does. And that's really, that's what he's always done. And he's very, very good at it. But that is, I mean, you could draw a straight line from Henny Youngman and through a whole bunch of other nightclub comics and straight to Jay. I mean, he's really of that ilk. So I think he's going to keep on doing that. And I think that somebody at some network is going to try to come up with some sort of show for Jay, because I think it makes total sense when you look at what his audience was. And his audience, toward the end, was certainly much diminished compared to what it was in the 90s and the last decade. But he still had, 3.5 to 4 million, or so viewers per night. They were older viewers than a lot of advertisers like to see, but they, viewers are viewers at a certain point.
Surely he'd fit in at CNN, chatting with politicos, reaching an older
audience.
Well,
there have been rumors about Jay. There have been rumors about Jay at CNN. I mean, I could certainly see that. I think that Jay, I think, was a little bit bruised by the 10 p.m. experience at NBC. I think all around the show didn't work, so it bombed. And I think also the whole Conan disaster, it certainly had a negative impact on him, on his image. He came out looking like the bad guy. He took Conan's job away.
And yet Jimmy Fallon does not have, who is taking over for Jay Leno only after only 5 years, I might add, in as a host of Late Night. He's kind of avoided that image.
Well, Jay gave his blessing.
Yeah, but I think a lot of what happened to Jay in 2010 stretched back really to what happened to Jay in 1992.
Right.
And I think that there was a lot of anger at Jay over getting the Tonight Show in the first place, because a lot of people believed that David Letterman deserved the job, and that NBC, in giving the show to Jay, had given it to a safer, blander, comedic talent, and that they had gone, they had sold out, that they had gone very corporate. They could have gone for the genius, and instead of going for the genius, they went for the guy who is like, the very, very safe salesman who comes in and does a very solid presentation, but there's not really a lot of pizzazz there. And I think that there was a lingering perception that that is what NBC did, and that Jay and his manager at the time kind of pushed them into that, and they fell for it. And so I think that when the whole Conan disaster happened, there was a lot of lingering resentment toward Jay. And then that all spilled out, all of that anger. There was such a volcano of rage directed at Jay that seemed actually kind of out of proportion to what had happened.
Well, as we said, it's a blow to Southern California and Burbank in particular as far as film and TV production. And the Los Angeles has just named Ken Ziffrin, the lawyer, who is Jay Leno's lawyer, as the new L.A. film czar, replacing the late Tom Sharrock. What can he do, if anything, to try and bring people back to the Southern California region?
How about a late night talk show?
That's kind of the thing. I mean, really, something like that is a fig leaf. I mean, you're appointing somebody who's a film czar, but the larger problem is not going to be able to be addressed by one person who has a mandate from, you know, city authorities. That's really not what is the problem here. The problem is that you have a state that, for various reasons, most of them political, does not want to offer incentives that other states and other territories are offering.
Most of them tax rebates.
Yeah, and if you're a producer, I mean, it's very bottom line oriented. You're saying, oh, well, you know, if we go to Louisiana and shoot this movie, we can do it for 20%, you know, 15 to 20% less than we're doing it here. And in bottom line terms, you could be talking, oh, we're going to save $8 million. And so the studio says, wow, that's great. Go to Louisiana and make the movie. So that's the problem. And for various reasons, you know, people in Sacramento saying, well, it's corporate welfare. Why does Tom Cruise need to get a rebate from us? So it becomes very difficult to sell this in Sacramento, even when Arnold Schwarzenegger was governor and, you know, Hollywood movie star, and he becomes governor. He wasn't able to do anything. I doubt, even though the state's finances are in much better shape than they were when Schwarzenegger was governor, it doesn't seem like the state is going to be able to match other places in terms of the incentives. So, I mean, it's good for Zifrin that he's become the czar, I guess. Whether it's going to solve LA's problems in terms of runaway production, I would be skeptical of that.
Well, certainly it's been a pleasure speaking with you about not only your article in the Times about, well, there were a couple of them as the Tonight Show wrapped up with Jay Leno. And of course, I follow you on Twitter where you're at Scott Collins LAT, and we'll place a link to that in the show notes. Thank you for taking the time to discuss The Tonight Show and Jay Leno and really what the future of late night holds. I greatly appreciate it, as I'm sure Michael does as well.
Great. Thanks, guys. I enjoyed it.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, take care.
Well, that was good of him to join us. That's Scott Collins from the LA Times.
That's right. And speaking of Jay Leno and late night, we got an email from listener Richard, who felt that NBC botched the handover from Leno to Fallon. He suggested maybe Fallon should have done guest hosting of The Tonight Show to let viewers to get used to him. Well, thanks for writing in, Richard, and we're glad you're listening to the podcast again after time away. Sperling, why would anyone stop listening to the podcast? I don't get that.
I'm sorry, you're saying Jimmy Fallon stopped listening to the podcast
should
fill in
stopped.
As a host for us? What are you talking about?
No. But there are two points to say about the questions he raised in his letter. The point I would make is that getting Fallon to guest host doesn't really work when he has his own talk show.
Right.
So he's not really available for guest hosting the way Jay was for Johnny. He was the regular substitute for Johnny like Joan Rivers was and so many other people were over the years. And so that opportunity wasn't really there because he was making a talk show 5 days a week.
That's right. And, you know, I love talking to Scott Collins because he really did underscore a number of issues. Jay Leno 1992 issue where he took over The Tonight Show instead of David Letterman. David Letterman went to CBS. Who knows if that didn't happen, whether there'd be this late night war. I'm sure that somehow
there would be,
yeah, because much like, you know, podcasts and other forms of media are fragmenting radio and news, the same is true of in television and late night talk shows.
Right. And and the whole family is in different rooms. You know, you got one kid in one room watching a tablet, another kid in another room watching, you know, Archer, another kid in another room watching this. Mom's watching the Olympics. Dad is watching that. You know, it happens all the time. So, I mean, it certainly is reflective of all the trends. But NBC did make one big move to launch Fallon as far as Richard's email. They told Leno to wrap it up 6 months early. You know, he was supposed to end right before the fall. But instead, they said, can you leave right before the Winter Olympics? And then we can use that platform to launch Fallon's debut to the biggest audience possible. So that was a very big move. That cost a lot of money. That was a big thing to get him to agree to leave early. So they did. They're doing everything they can to make sure Fallon is the guy of the future. He's certainly the Merv Griffin of the future. That's how I see him.
You see. Oh, why is that?
Jimmy Fallon? Because he loves everybody. They're all his best friend. It's just very, very, very light. Not that you get hard-hitting interviews in late night, but he says, oh, my God, I love you so much. Oh, you're so funny. Oh, my God, you're hilarious. Now my next wonderful guest. You know, that's very Merv Griffin as far as I'm concerned.
Ah, okay. Well, you know, as Richard pointed out, or Richard suggested, it would have been interesting to see Fallon maybe take a week off of his own show, guest host for Leno, and then have maybe Seth Meyers or whoever they were grooming to take over for...
No, because you need your team in place, because you can't do his show with your team, then you're just doing your show an hour earlier. I mean, it doesn't work.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, I was
It's just like watching liking John Oliver. It took him weeks to get, you know, where he was trying to do something distinct because he was doing John's show with John's team. We'll have to see how he does on HBO when he has his own talk show. That'll be hopefully a different and better beast.
Well, you know, just trying to make Richard's idea work. And Richard did write into dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. And, you know, you could write to us and maybe I know that the late night wars here in the United States is a, you know, North American centric thing, but please write to us. Let us know what your late night talk shows are like in the UK, Australia, France. Let us know. dirt@showbizsandbox.com. If there's a subject in any of those countries, in any country around the world that we should be covering, please do write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com, or you can call us. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's +1-888-567-7263. Links to all the stories we've discussed in today's show can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com, in the show notes for episode 224. That's also where you'll find those ways to contact us and ways to follow us. You can follow us on Twitter, @ShowbizSandbox is our username on Twitter, and you can search for us on Facebook and like us on Facebook. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox. Again, showbizsandbox.com is where you'll find all that information, as well as ways to subscribe to the show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, any podcast aggregator. We give the show away for free. Please do subscribe. Please do rate and review the show in any of those aggregators. It does help us out. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has an ever-changing revolving doors worth of websites. What is it this week, Michael?
Graham Norton is quite naughty.com.
And I guess you'll have to look that one up and Google that, and I think you'll find he's
a big top UK talk show.
That's right.
The first one to do a like nightly show, just like Johnny, you know, 4 or 5 nights a week. Unheard of in the UK until Graham came along.
Ah, okay. Well, if you can't find Michael's work there, try michaelgiltz.com or run on over to the Huffington Post or any one of the outlets that Michael writes for. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.